Next up, as we've heard today, the newly passed spending bill is a big boost for some planetary science. But other areas like space technology didn't fare so well. And my next guest says that's a problem for our long-term goals in space. How are we going to send humans to Mars someday, for example, without investing now in the technology to safely land them there and perhaps bring them back? Mason Peck is former chief technologist at NASA. He's also a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Peck.
Hello, it's great to be with you.
I also want to challenge our listeners out there to tell us what space technology they want to see. Do they want to see solar sails, the ever-popular space elevator, that kind of stuff? What would you like to see? Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let us know. You can also phone us at 844-724-8255, 844-724-8255. Let's talk about do you think technology is getting a short shrift in this spending bill, Mason?
Well, I think to some extent, yes. I mean, first, the budget does strongly support NASA. You know, it's one of the few agencies that got a plus up in this this Cromnibus, so-called, right? But the space technology program particularly, this is something that in the early years of the Obama administration might have been funded at the level of $1 billion. It would have been a significant fraction, maybe 5% of NASA's total. Lately has only been funded at maybe $500 million, $600 million a year. Now, that sounds like a large amount of money to you and me. Mm-hmm. But if you take it in the context, a broader context, it's a very small fraction and probably not enough to achieve all the goals that we're going to need to achieve, as you say, to get to Mars, to explore asteroids, and also do all the planetary science that we'd like to do in the future.
And why do you think that it's getting short shrift?
I think it's hard for folks to understand the value of investment now for the much longer term. You know, even though we look at planetary science and some of the exciting human missions like Orion and SLS as investments in the future, those are comparatively near term. You know, it's talking about 5-10 years in the future. But going to Mars, this is something that's 20 years out, we think. In order to be ready 20 years from now, we have to start investing now mm-hmm. in entry, descent, and landing technologies, for example, propulsion technologies, technologies to keep astronauts safe on the way there and back. These all have to be done, and they are being done, but, you know, frankly, kind of slowly. It's going to take some resources to get there. It's just hard, I think, for people to separate the tactical benefits of investing in things like a rocket today from investing a smaller amount of money now to make a bigger impact later.
Let's talk about some of these cutting-edge projects you're working on. Let's talk about the tiny Sprite satellites. What's the idea there?
So this idea is something we've been working on at Cornell since about 2006. We're talking about spacecraft that are really tiny, about the size of a coin. It started in earnest in about 2011. We were working with Lockheed and NASA. We launched three prototypes to the space station. And these days, you know, you can do a lot of very exciting science and technology on the space station. We call those things Sprites. Not a good reason for it. It's just a cool name. We got them back from their three-year visit to space just a few months ago, and they survived. They worked great. Turns out that you can build a spacecraft out of commercial parts in some cases, and they can communicate to Earth. A student of mine, Zach Manchester, designed most of the Sprite technology. One of the extraordinary innovations is he's figured out a way for them to communicate, even though they're that small, from over 1,000 kilometers away, just using a fraction of a watt of power.
Would these be like swarms of satellites, little coin-sized things?
I think you could create a swarm of satellites, but one of the real benefits to this, in my view at least, is it really lowers the bar for what it takes to get into space. When we launched a few of these in April, we launched, in fact, 100 of them, we funded that mission with a Kickstarter campaign. So there were actually hundreds of people around the world who provided small amounts of money each. And in total, we got something like two or three times the amount we'd asked for, enough to build a satellite the size of a loaf of bread. We packed it with 100 satellites, smaller satellites, the Sprites, and sent that to orbit.
Huh.
The outcome is, you know, for a few $100, you can get into space. And that is it's a watershed event. The fact that we can now expect as just members of the public to participate in space exploration and science, I think that's a trend toward democratizing.
What a great school project this could be for kids.
Yeah, I think it's rare to be able to launch your senior project, let's say, but now even high school students are in the business of launching small satellites. Thomas Jefferson High School in the D.C. area, they launched a small satellite.
Huh.
So, you know, it's a different world from when you and I were in school. We wouldn't have that expectation, but that's been the benefit of investing in technology over the last few decades.
Yeah, I was happy with a water rocket. One thing you've talked about is actually making satellites in space, like 3D printing them. How would you do that?
I think
that
would be really exciting. I mean, yeah. Some of us have been calling that massless exploration, the idea that since right now all the mass we need to build things for space we take from the Earth, someday we may be able to use regolith from the moon or asteroids or even Mars and shape that into what we want for exploration. One thing we've been saying is that all the mass we need to explore the solar system is already in space. It's just in the wrong shape.
It's in the wrong shape.
That's right.
Ah, you mean we could just 3D print them in the right shape once we're up there?
You could 3D print them. There's other forms of additive manufacturing also. But one of the exciting things about this idea of 3D printing satellites or just fabricating them in space is it leverages some of the advances in 3D printing we think about on the Earth. You know, so often we think of NASA technology as an opportunity for spin-offs. That is, when we invest in space exploration, we get all these new technologies that benefit us here on Earth. And it's quite astonishing the payback the U.S. taxpayer gets. But every now and then they spin back into NASA, back into exploration. And consumer electronics and 3D printing, that's an example of that. Mm-hmm. So someday we may be able to 3D print them and we may be able to use resources not from Earth.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Mason Peck, former chief technologist at NASA, who's a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Cornell University in Ithaca. You know, you began to answer one of the questions I was going to talk about, which people ask all the time, is what's in it for Earth? You know, why are we spending that money in going up into space when there are all these problems on Earth that need to be tackled?
Yeah, there's a lot of answers to that. Let me give you the best one I have, which is that whenever we take on an extraordinary problem, like sending humans to the moon or to Mars, exploring Europa, when we take on those hard problems, innovation's necessary. And when we innovate, we really can't tell where that innovation is going to go. Certainly in the nearer term, those innovations help us achieve those science and exploration goals. But in the longer term, they turn into products and services that make American companies competitive. They create jobs. They save lives. They create revenue. In fact, if you look at some of the studies that have been done on when we invest in space, whether it's science or technology, the payback on Earth is a factor of 2 to 7. I mean, look, if you and I could invest money in our own savings accounts and something that pays back at that rate, we would definitely do so. That's one reason it's so disappointing that Congress hasn't yet supported the space technology program at the level that we think it should be supported.
We have a tweet from Julia Block who says, I wonder if I'll see space tourism in my lifetime. Do you think that's going to happen, or is that something that's an idea whose time has come and gone?
Well, she's already seen space tourism. Right. It's been going on for close to a decade now. There have been private visitors to a space station. Some of it's facilitated by the Russians. I think we will see something like space tourism. I'm not sure it's the killer app, though. And that really is what we need for space commercialization to take off. For there to be a commercial space industry, we need to find those applications, those reasons to go to space beyond only tourism. Huh. It's got to be manufacturing. It's got to be resources, for example, from asteroids. Whatever those applications are, that's what's going to drive the economy for space in the future.
Another technology you're working on is sort of a tractor beam with magnets. Tell us about that. Please.
That's right. So you can never go wrong being inspired by Star Trek, right? This idea has to do with magnetism. Of course, we all know that you can attract a piece of iron or steel with a permanent magnet, but you can't attract aluminum, copper, or almost any other conductor unless you move the magnet around. And it turns out, and we've come up with ways to do this at Cornell University, if you move the magnet around just right, you can pull on, push on, slide left and right a conductive surface. So since spacecraft are mostly made out of conductors like aluminum, copper, carbon fiber, all sorts of conductive materials, if we do it right, we can create a moving magnet that attracts or pulls or pushes or slides a neighboring spacecraft, which has so many uses. We could use it for fixing spacecraft, refueling them, maybe even building them in place. Huh. It's not as extraordinary as the Star Trek tractor beam. You have to be a few feet away at most. But still, you can do all this without contacting the spacecraft, wow. And that means it's safe and reliable.
In the minute I got left, I want you to talk about your water-based propulsion system you guys are cooking up at Cornell.
Yeah, that's a fun one too, because it really does it does inform this idea of massless exploration. We start with water. We electrolyze it with electricity, breaking it up into oxygen and hydrogen components, and then you combust that with a spark plug. It's really simple. It's actually been done before in other contexts. Well, we've come up with a way to do this that is so simple that you could probably fly a spacecraft to an asteroid and refuel it using water that you find there. So if your goal were to prospect for, you know, heavy metals on asteroids or do some science, you could do this without requiring that all the fuel come from Earth. You refuel with water along the way. And if you want to refuel your spacecraft, for example, the large rocket, the Space Launch System, you could possibly refuel that with water.
Where's the power come from?
It's still power the same way.
How do you, it's solar power. That's what, when I walked on you, you said that. Yeah, it's solar power.
Yeah, that's right.
And pay for it.
Right, so solar energy provides the energy, if you like, and rather than storing it in batteries, you're storing it in the fuel itself. And so when you combust that, all that energy comes out at once, and it's a high-speed propellant.
Sounds exciting, Mason. We'll look forward to seeing what you guys are cooking up in the lab in Cornell. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Mason Nepeck, former chief technologist at NASA. He's also a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Cornell University up in Ithaca, New York.